Law and Grace, Chapter 12, Part A. What the Law Could Not Do. Subtitled, The Law's Own Witness to Its Insufficiency. The law, said Paul, is holy, and the commandment holy and just and good. How truly he spoke. We have had ample reason to see. None can disagree with his verdict after the researches and discoveries which we have made thus far. We've seen the law performed to perfection, its wonderful work of educating Israel in the things of God. We've watched literal and symbolical ordinances alike make plain to them that the goal of their national existence was absolute holiness to the Lord. As his covenant people, they were to regard themselves as his representatives on earth, letting their light so shine before men of other nations that these would see their good works and glorify the Lord in heaven. The things of the Spirit were to be their meditations all the day and oust completely the things of the flesh. Whatever they did was to be done heartily as to the Lord, knowing that he beheld all their doings and delighted in their worship of him in spirit and in truth. The aim of his demands upon them was that they should fear the Lord their God, to walk in all his ways, to love him and to serve the Lord their God with all their heart and with all their soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes which he commanded them for their good. His choice of them had been made with the express purpose that they should honour those demands and be in fact, as well as in status, a holy and peculiar people. The function of the law as a whole was to bring that momentous fact urgently home to them, constraining them so to live in purity and holiness that he could rightly and truly dwell among them, they being his people and he their God. Yet, the law is no more. It has waxed old and long since vanished away. Why should so superlative a code have been abrogated to give place to something else? The question clamours for an answer, but we have not far to look to find it. It is within the law itself, so much clearer still for us to behold than for those who lived under its jurisdiction, because we have learned of Christ. Comprehended briefly in the Ten Commandments were the whole of the moral demands of the law, but it was not for this alone that the commandments were unique. Their preeminence was specially signalized by the fact that God himself spoke them to Israel and communicated to them the authority of his own heavenly voice. He declared unto you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even 10 commandments. He wrote them upon 2 tables of stone. In no other way could their fundamental importance have been made clearer to Israel than that. Yet how ominously significant were the circumstances attending their delivery. The mountain burned with fire unto the midst of heaven, with darkness, clouds, and thick darkness. And the Lord spake out of the midst of the fire. If such terribleness characterized the law in its beginning, what should the ending of it be? The dreadfulness of Sinai was truly portentous. It signified that the covenant there made not merely required obedience like that made with the Father centuries before, but, unlike that, actually exacted it to the accompaniment of threats of penal sanctions. The people were quite aware of this when they accepted it and entered into it. Three times in all they avowed their readiness to render the obedience it demanded. All that the Lord hath said will we do and be obedient. Not till they had thus thrice pledged their troth did Moses sprinkle sacrificial blood upon them in token of the fact that they had finally entered into it. All the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. And such were the words which Moses returned unto the Lord on their behalf. And it was for that reason that God said in turn to them, ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man do, he shall live in them. I am the Lord. To live, a man had to do. That is, the right to life itself would be forfeited by disobedience. None but those who did the things which the law required would retain that right. And then only for as long as they continued so to do. The law was inexorable, teaching with ruthless thoroughness that the wages of sin is death. The people's renunciation at Sinai of the privilege of hearing God speak direct, pleasing to him though it was as an expression of their awe and their consciousness of sin, had nevertheless another, a sinister significance. It amounted to a repudiation of God himself. And for this reason, the terrors accompanying the delivery of the law were also prophetic of the calamitous judgments which it would bring down upon a disobedient and gainsaying people. Obedience, to justify the name, had to be absolute, all-embracing in scope as well as perfect in quality. Not one single lapse in the smallest matter was compatible with the covenant promise made by the people. All will we do. Hence the comprehensive curse. Cursed be he that confirmeth not all the words of this law to do them. This was the culminating and transcendent curse in a catalogue of 12, indicating that whosoever kept the whole law, yet offended in one point, was on that account guilty of all, and so fell under its curse. And such was the terror foreshadowed by the awesome spectacle of Sinai, altogether on a smoke. The law, while pointing out the way of life, nay, as we shall see, in order to point it out, was destined to become death to all who sought life by it. While it demonstrated perfectly to a man what was at enmity in him against God, it could not help him one whit to vanquish it. It merely brought him consciously into its power. Sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived him, and by it slew him. The law demonstrated to him beyond cavil that whereas it was itself spiritual, he, on the contrary, was carnal, sold under sin, which thus worked death in him by that which was good. By the law was the knowledge of sin, and of nothing more, save death, which came inevitably in its train. The law gave clear intimation of that fact through its ritual. Stern irony characterized its insistence on certain significant occasions that the obedience which it demanded had to take the form of a confession of disobedience. This arrangement was paradoxical, but nevertheless both revealing and necessary in order that the law might be true to its purpose. Thus, the Nazarite, type and exemplar of the true Israelite though he was, could not declare his vow accomplished on his own authority, but only on the conditions laid down by the law. And these insisted, ironically yet realistically, that though he could undertake the formal conclusion of his period of separation only by virtue of having observed the separation faultlessly, the first offering which he had to present was to be a sin offering, in recognition of the fact that despite his ritual sinlessness over one particular religious exercise, he was still a sinner and astray from God. As his own hand slew his offering, he openly acknowledged his own just deserts to be likewise death, and confessed that left to himself, he was powerless to avert it. The same great lesson was taught by the ceremonial of the consecration of the priesthood. Aaron and his sons were a type of Israel as God's holy people, yet before they could put on the robes prescribed for them for glory and for beauty, they had first to wash in recognition of their unworthiness to wear them. And then, having been enrobed and anointed, had forthwith to present to God a sin offering for their cleansing, in ritual confession of the inadequacy of their priestly service. In them, idealism and realism converged and fused together. Their physical perfection was of vital importance to their symbolic function as types, both of the ideal Israel and even of God himself in his ineffable holiness, but it was never more than symbolic. It signified indeed what was essential and indispensable in true priesthood, but one significant feature of their consecration indicated conclusively that no priest either would or could arise of the Aaronic order to bring what was desirable to pass, to change the ideal into the real. This was the mediatorial work of Moses. For 7 whole days, Aaron and his sons had passively to submit to the ritual of their consecration, depending entirely upon Moses to bring their offerings into relation with the altar. Throughout that week, the breast of each peace offering which they offered fell to him. Moses took the breast and waved it for a wave offering before the Lord, for of the ram of consecration it was Moses' part, as the Lord commanded Moses. This was no haphazard arrangement, but one observed by decree of God, as the Lord commanded Moses. As later, all who presented peace offerings at the sanctuary would have to surrender the wave breast as a token of their dependence upon the mediatorial ministrations of the priesthood. So here at its own consecration service of all times, the priesthood itself had to acknowledge its own need of one to represent it before God. And to show that Aaron and his sons needed Moses' services, not as men, but as priests, the law decreed that he should wave the shoulder immediately before sprinkling with mingled oil and blood both them and their robes which they were now wearing, and that they in turn should not be permitted to eat their portion of the ram of consecration until that anointing by him had taken place. So great, in fact, was the priest's need that even on the eighth day, when they entered into the actual discharge of their office, Moses was again required to act for them by introducing Aaron to the tabernacle and his duties therein, and so inducting him into that office. Yet Moses could not actually do this until, again, Aaron, approaching the altar for the very first time, we note, had offered his sin offering and his burnt offering in order to make atonement for himself and for the people. Not only for himself, but also for the people, since what held good for him held good for them, he and they being ritually one. Such was the ruthlessness with which the law made the confession of disobedience the prerequisite of obedience, and made what blamelessness it was capable of giving contingent upon the repeated ritual avowal of blame by those who sought it. It was a sublime paradox, but a necessary one, so that the law itself might clearly show that it made nothing perfect, and was essentially made not for the righteous, but for the lawless and disobedient, in order that their sin might be condemned by it. As with the priests, so also with the offerings. What was characteristic of the former was characteristic also of the latter. This conclusion is obvious on the strength of one fact alone. The offerings, like the priests, had to be perfect. If animals, they had to be without blemish. If flour, they had to be without defect or roughness by being of the finest. This arrangement enabled the offerer to give his ritual assent to the fact that God, being absolutely holy, could be satisfied with nothing short of absolute holiness in him if he was to be true to himself. And when, in the case of animal sacrifice, the offerer proceeded next to slay his offering, its ritual perfection at once stood out in stark contrast to the blood which spoke of failure to attain such absolute holiness by him who shed it, and allowing perfection to be imputed to him despite his failure, according to the promise. It is the blood that maketh atonement by reason of the life. But where was the actual sinlessness which God demanded? The animal's physical perfection was a wonderful symbol of it, but never more than a symbol. No sinner's conscience could be satisfied by the ritual unless he felt that there was something real which gave it validity. None could be foolish enough to think that God could be fobbed off with an artificial substitute for the genuine sinlessness which he demanded. That is, the offerings were eloquent in their testimony as to what was desirable, but they, again, could go no further than that. Well able though they were to prescribe the indispensable remedy for sin, they were nevertheless powerless to provide it. truly the atonement which they procured for the offerer was real atonement. The law did not state idly of the man who brought a sin offering, "And the priest shall make an atonement for him as concerning his sin, and it shall be forgiven him." Yet that did not mean, nor could mean to any reflective person, that the atoning power possessed by the blood of the sacrificial animal was intrinsic. God's decree was in any case too explicit to justify any such assumption. "The life of the flesh is in the blood, and I've given it to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls." Nothing could be clearer. Such atoning power as the blood possessed had merely been communicated to it. Yet, if God were to remain true to himself, he could not have communicated this potency to the blood arbitrarily, to neglect a fundamental moral principle. It was forbidden to him as much as to man to permit a symbol to serve as a substitute for the reality which it symbolized. In the absolute sense, it was both wrong and impossible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sin. That blood could only take away sin in those days, in the same way as baptism does in our day, by virtue of something else which communicated its efficacy to it. Thus the motive with which the law assigned atoning power to mere animal blood was an ulterior one, namely, to testify to the need for a sacrifice that was literally, as distinct from ritually, perfect and efficacious to remove sin, and to teach Israel to look expectantly for it. In doing this, the law set one day apart to give special emphasis to the fact that the perfect sacrifice to come would be unique and all-availing, one which would fulfill the symbolism of all the animal offerings in their diversity, one which would in actual fact cleanse Israel that they might be clean from all their sins before the Lord. In anticipation of the ultimate offering of that one perfect and transcendent sacrifice, and as a token of its absolute atoning power, this day, the Day of Atonement, was declared a Sabbath of rest unto them. But, as clinching proof that neither the bullock nor the goat of sin offering offered upon that day was the perfect offering in question, the law arranged that this day should recur with every returning year. "This shall be an everlasting statute unto you to make an atonement for the children of Israel for all their sins once a year." Thus, the law confessed that while it condemned men, it could not save them. Its ritual covering of sin effected at best only a ritual approach to God, only a real atonement could effect a real approach. The law vowed that it condemned men but could not save them, and this grimly ironical fact received its most conspicuous expression when, in punishment of the people's murmurings, the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. A serpent bite followed by death. The allusion to Eden was palpable, and the allegory transparent. Once again, the literal and physical was the sign and symbol of the spiritual. The murmurs were representative of the people as a whole. The serpents were likewise symbolic of what was at work in them all due to Adam's lapse in Eden, that is, sin, and their deadly bite, symbolic of sin's murderous power. Once bitten, the victims were doomed to die. No striving to be sinless could alter their fate. Their only hope lay in utter reliance upon the mercy and compassion of God on the basis of humble and contrite confession of their sin. The very speed with which the venom of the serpents acted compelled them to realize dramatically how hopeless was their case unless God came to their aid. Therefore, the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against thee. Pray unto the Lord that he take away the serpents from us." Consciously or unconsciously, they confessed that sin was killing them, and they wanted God to take it and its effects, that is, the serpents and their deadly bite, away from them, that they might live. Moses acted for them, and God responded to their cry. Yet, in the strangest fashion, the Lord decreed, "If the whole congregation of Israel sin, then the congregation shall offer a young bullock for the sin, and the priest shall make an atonement for them, and it shall be forgiven them." How mystifying, therefore, yet also how revealing, that this time no sacrifice was prescribed according to the law, nor atonement made by the shedding of animal blood. Nothing could have more effectively intimated to them the impotence of both the sacrifices and the priesthood than the fact that on this momentous occasion, something wholly novel, something altogether distinct from the law and its ritual, was prescribed. The Lord said unto Moses, "Make thee a fiery serpent, and set it upon a pole, and it shall come to pass that every one that is bitten, when he looketh upon it, shall live." There's a footnote here regarding the priesthood. It was the priest, we note, who had to make atonement with the sin offering, yet it was Moses, not Aaron, whom the people asked to intercede for them. The arrangement seemed fantastic, but Moses obeyed and made a serpent of brass and put it upon a pole. The next step lay with the victims. Some doubtless turned their gaze away in ridicule and contempt and died in their sin. But not all. It came to pass that if a serpent had bitten any man, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. The wise ones looked and lived. Where their works condemned them, their faith saved them. They survived, but their faithless brethren perished. The lesson was not only for them, it was for all time. When the thoughtful pondered the mystery of this deliverance, they would see in it the promise of sin vanquished by a divine arrangement, which lay altogether outside the purview of the law itself, one to which the law pointed men, but which it could not itself provide. they would come to see also the significance of the brazen serpent. It was a replica of what had been, that had given the people a mortal bite, that is, of sin itself. Being of brass, it spoke also of sin as a property of human nature. It was conspicuously exhibited on a pole that those who looked at it to be healed might live. Live, not die, paradoxically. For while the serpent symbolized sin, it was not sin in an active and destructive form, but sin rendered impotent and shorn of its deadly power. The lesson to be learned from this was that God would effect their deliverance from sin and death, the serpent's venom serving only, like the murderer's blow, to accelerate sin's work of bringing men to certain death by putting sin itself to death in the brass of human nature over which it reigned triumphant. What they themselves as its victims could never achieve by their own efforts, God himself would accomplish for them. Not through the law, however, but despite it. There's another footnote here regarding that passage regarding the divine arrangement which lay altogether outside the purview of the law itself, one to which the law pointed men but which it could not itself provide. This was the inference which the Lord himself drew from the incident and the lesson which he wished Nicodemus to see in it. Not so the critics, however. The incident, say they, is wholly mythical, and the record of it valueless except as evidence that the early religion of Israel was characterized by totem worship, and thus do they substitute their own scholarly authority for that of the faithful and true witness. Though claiming him as their heavenly teacher and things divine, they yet do not hesitate to discount his testimony where it conflicts with their own preconceptions, thereby professing to be wiser than he in matters directly affecting his mission as Saviour, matters in regard to which it is unthinkable that he should either deliberately mislead men by cynical conformity to the false ideas of his time, or be himself ignorant and in need of correction. It is indeed ironical that Jesus should have prefaced his allusion to this wilderness incident with a weighty claim. Verily, verily, I say unto thee, we speak that we do know and testify that we have seen, and then have added words which will acquire a new and still more tragic relevance in view of the critic's attitude. And ye receive not our testimony. The law killed. Sooner or later, every Israelite, try as he might, found that to be true experimentally. But it could not make a lie. Its work stopped short at death. Necessarily so, else it would not only have rivaled the covenant made with the fathers, would also in practice have stultified it altogether. For whereas the covenant made with the fathers spoke of the inheritance of the land forever, that made at Sinai made inheritance contingent upon obedience, and so terminable by death for all, seeing that all would disobey it. In face of this, the Israelite may well have asked, why then had the second covenant been added? He would, upon reflection, see two reasons for this. Both of them explaining the essential nature of that second covenant as a code demanding the performance of righteous works by him. To begin with, the law made increasingly obvious to him, the longer he lived, that he was utterly dependent upon the first covenant. This promised blessing for all nations, in reversal of the Edenic sentence, which brought cursing upon all, and in contradistinction to the law itself, which likewise brought cursing, not blessing, upon all who were subject to it. Secondly, the law, setting as it did an exalted and objective standard of holiness, stressed that God, though merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, was yet the Holy One. That will by no means clear the guilty. That is, the law made plain that God's merciful willingness to pardon sin must never be construed as a toleration of it, or connivance at it, or induce any trifling with it in those who avail themselves of his boundless long-suffering. This second reason was thus complementary to the first. The simple fact was that the law was never designed to relate a man to eternal life. And not only was that in itself a truism, but the law went to the extent of admitting it. It made clear that its purpose was merely to persuade men of their need for life, and to point out the terms on which they could lay hold of it. Its weakness thus became its strength when it frankly avowed, in symbolism plain for all to understand who would, that it could not take men beyond the confines of this earthly life. And, moreover, was never designed to do so.